session number 9552, reel 15.
Mr. Basil Farrow, Reel 15. What happened after this attack on Bernafrey Wood and Transwood?
Well, the date would be either the 7th or the 8th, I couldn't say precisely. We were withdrawn again, behind a certain distance, to where I don't recollect, if I did, even if I knew at the time, but to bivouacs outside. And to be wait for reinforcements, I suppose, because we'd suffered casualties. How many I don't remember, but we'd suffered casualties nevertheless.
Up to this point, then, you were being only used as attack troops. You were put in the line for one attack, then withdrawn.
Yes.
Then you were put in the line for another attack,
yes,
and then withdrawn. You didn't actually hold the line at all in
the sector
up to this point.
No, in for attacking, and we were out about a week. 10 days, or well, from the 8th to the round about the 20th, I think. Having received reinforcements, we moved back, and I remember we moved back to the practically. We were fortunate, I think, in that respect. All our that was possibly the position of the division on the right of the line, so they wouldn't switch us about. They wouldn't move the divisions from. So we were always in that line. From Montemont straight forward to Bernafrey, Transwood, and then after that, behind that, was a little village called Guillemont, or Guillemont, as we would say at the time. Guillemont. Guillemont. Well, that was just beyond Transwood. We were attacking there. We went into that attack, and I remember at the regimental aid post, and there's a I was scared stiff, and I don't know whether I asked what or whether I was sent to back as far as the RAMC to bring the RAMC stretcher bearers to the regimental aid post, and I found them at the corner of Transwood, and there was a padre there, and this again I do remember, he was cheering the men on, you know, and giving them words of comfort, and he was distributing cigarettes. Now, one has heard since of Woodbine Willie. Have you heard of him? Woodbine Willie was the chap who formed at Tuck H.
Oh, Clayton, you mean?
Clayton, yes. So it must have been him, because I'd never seen a parson. Of course, he was in khaki, but he's got a dog collar, you see. Never so far forward, because he was actually in the battle area, was Woodbine Willie. So it must have been him, and I brought up the RMC stretcher bearers to the regimental aid post. And then carried on with my job. And how I got through that day, I have little recollection of the actual happenings, really. I haven't. And eventually we were withdrawn from late that night. We were withdrawn again. We didn't stay in overnight.
Do you remember?
In none of these attacks, neither the 1st of July, Transwood, we didn't stay in the position all night.
Do you remember if it was a successful attack, successful in general terms, on Guillemont?
No, I don't remember whether it was or not, because our regiment wasn't the only one engaged. The old brigade, if not the division, were engaged in that. So whether it was successful, I think they did capture Guillemont. But we were withdrawn that same night.
Was it your impression that you were suffering more at this attack than you had done on, say, the 1st? Was it a disastrous affair, or?
Well, it seemed to me that the starting off point, we were a damn sight nearer the Jerry's than we had been before. And it being in the village, there was a hang of a racket going off. That's all I remember of it. The terrific noise.
What was the during this thing? What were the ground conditions like, and what were the battlefield conditions like as we moved later into July?
Well, there in the communication trench, the trench was intact. Strange to say that where the regiment lay post, the trench was intact right down to Trones Wood, and beyond. Then went into the village, and then of course it was open. Well, the village itself has. I wasn't in the village, but only on the fringe. But the ground had been well shelled, all uneven, and I don't recollect any barbed, any obstacles, anything like that. But just an uneven ground. That is to say, obviously, in that whole area, if you've seen aerial photographs of the Somme, shell holes touched one another, and it was like that, very much.
Had the area's drainage broke down? Was it muddy by then? It was midsummer.
I don't remember. I think it was dry. I think the weather was dry.
Was there any problem with getting your rations and things like that through to the battlefield area?
Well, during the actual battle, there's no question of getting your rations through. Your two quart rations you had, and you had to live on them, whatever you had. And there was no question of getting in during the battle getting rations through. That was absolutely out. I mean, what would have to be got through would be ammunition. I mean, I'm speaking now. Logically, I mean, as far as I was concerned, nothing. But the fighting man, he'd eventually, if he survived that, to that extent, he only carries 150 rounds. Well, he'd want more, so ammunition's got to be taken up. The same for the Lewis guns. We had Lewis guns then. We didn't have because originally, right at the very origin, battalions only had two machine guns, and then came. The Lewis gun with the circular thing. We didn't have the automatic weapons they have now. And then, of course, the machine gun corps was formed as a corps. And that was that.
So you lived during the day. I realise you're only in the line for a day.
Yeah.
But would you just live on your emergency rations during that time, or would you not even open those?
If I recall rightly, you could only use your emergency rations with the authority of an officer, if I recall rightly.
So
it'd be the rations you'd been issued early morning, and of course ensure your water bottle is full. Because you had a water bottle.
Before an attack, were you given an extra ration of rum or anything like that?
I have a vague recollection. Only vague. The ration of rum was 2 tablespoonfuls as a rule. And I have a vague recollection. I don't know whether I don't remember receiving it on July the 1st, whether we did or not. Because rum is... I've had it in the ordinary course of events when we stood to, when we were all in the line, and I think whether it says so or not, you give an extra ration of rum when you went over the top, but I personally have no recollection of it. Any certain recollection of an extra ration of rum.
So, round about the 20th... somewhere in the early 20s you were at Gillimore. Where did you go from there then? You were pulled back out of the line.
Pulled back out of the line. Where we went to, I don't know. I don't know whether it was in the village or not. I have no recollection. But we were moved from the Somme and went up to La Basse sector.
What was the condition of the battalion as far as possible that you could say when it on being pulled out of the Somme? Was it badly damaged or was it in reasonable condition?
I think it was in reasonable condition. I wouldn't say we'd lost 50%. We were lucky, I think. On the right of the line, we suffered far less in all the attacks, I think. I honestly could not say whether we were 50% casualties or not. I don't remember. I don't honestly remember. Even if I observed them, I would only be concerned with my own company, you know, B company.
Had you lost many friends?
I don't remember having very many friends. Close friends. I don't remember having a close friend, strange to say. I don't. We were all comrades together, but I don't remember a close friend. Whether it was too young or what, I don't remember.
Which part of the Labasse sector did you go to?
Well, first of all, we moved up there to Béthune. I think we were in might have been a school there for a night. Then we moved up by the canal to a village called Givenchy. There were two, but there was Givenchy and Coinchy, I think. Givenchy, and then Quincy. Whether that was on the other side of the canal, I've forgotten. But the canal was right there, and there was a brickyard, if I remember rightly, at the side of the canal. But the trenches were Givenchy. In front of Givenchy, that is, the village of Givenchy. That was in ruins. I do remember going up, because we were in that part of the line for in and out for from July, end of July, till we were taken back again in end of September. Therefore, we were 2 months up there. And I remember in Givenchy village there was a cemetery for the Indian troops there, so they'd been there, because I remember that cemetery. And I also remember, I have a vague recollection, there was a kid used to go up in the front line trench with the Daily Mail. That's a kind of a memory. And he was stopped going with all kinds of rumours coming about that he was somebody behind, he was giving them the information as to who was in the front line trench. Anyhow,
a French lad?
A French boy, yes. Because there was a village just behind where, when we were in reserve, we were in this village. I've forgotten the name of the village. Or a hamlet, so you know, not a village.
What was the situation where you were in the line? How far apart of the line?
It was a very nasty part of the line for the simple reason that we were near enough to not only shell, which is bad enough, but trench mortars. We weren't the mortar blocks, it was the artillery who had the mortars in a trench behind. We had were near enough to use trench mortars. Well, that's a range of about 100 yards or so, then no more, even close to 80 to 150 yards, I don't know. But very close enough, not only trench mortars, but rifle grenades.
Taking the trench mortars first, we'll come to the graph. The British had them in the second line then?
In a line, not in the front line, they had them in the second line.
Was this a fixed position, or would they come in and out?
They had orders, so I understood. I have a regular understand they had orders to send over so many a day. I mean, they couldn't just chuck them all the time. They had nevertheless did so many to, and when they'd done that, they'd done their stint. They were relieved, and I think that they were rationed, not limited, but they'd got to get rid of a number.
Would the sight of the mortar change?
It would have to do, because you can see the mortar going over. Well, therefore, Jerry would see where it came from. So they'd have to change quickly.
Did they attract a lot of counterfire?
They did. They attracted what they call Minenwerfer, which is the German trench mortar. Now, our trench mortar, we call them, it was like a big round thing, fairly big. Oh, bigger than balls on the bowling green, much bigger than that. It's about the size of three or four of those altogether, quite a thing. With a long steel handle. That was in the mortar thing, and that went over, and you could see that going, the handle going round.
Spinning in the air.
And very often that would fly back, the handle would. Because if it landed the ball there, the handle behind, because the handle would fly back. The Jerry's, they had a mini-werfer. That was a big canister. And it made a hell of a noise when it dropped. But you could see that coming. So you had time to run to dodge it if you could. But the unfortunate thing is, Jerry, like ourselves, knew that you could see that coming. He would send on either side a rifle grenade, so that if you were running away from the mini werfer, you'd run into a rifle brigade, a rifle grenade. You see, but they were nasty things. In addition to, as I say, to ordinary, you weren't near enough to be able to fling a bomb. But the ground was very, very uneven for this reason. Being so near, there was another thing which I feared. I've told you I feared.
Could we just can I just ask a bit more about the Minnenwerfer? Did they fly in an easily identifiable direction? Because, or did they move about in the air?
Oh no, they went in the direction they were intended to be.
So it was fairly easy to tell where they were going to land.
Yes. Oh yes.
What was the effect when they landed?
A terrific bang.
Were they very
louder than the shell?
Were they as destructive or more destructive than the shell?
I think they were more frightening than destructive. If you were near them, of course you would be blown to bits. But they were more frightening than destructive.
Now you say when the British mortars opened fire that they'd attract German mortar fire back.
Yes.
Would this cause any Were you a bit unkeen on the...
We were very unkeen for this reason. This would go on, the exchange, but they'd be firing their mini-werfer into our trench, and our mortar blokes would be firing the... So, we'd... somebody would phone back to the artillery to put a stop to this. And then it would develop into an artillery blinking, but the blinking muck would be falling into our respective trenches, and we didn't like it at all. We didn't like it, truly. Because it could develop into a very nasty, not attack, but being on the receiving end of quite a lot of mortars and shells. And then they gradually die down. So we weren't near enough to be able to fling.
What about rifle grenades? Did the British use rifle grenades as well?
Yes. Yes.
What? You say they used to fire them on either. The Germans fired them on either side of the Minnenwerfer. What sort of impact did a rifle grenade have? Were they accurate to fire and things? Would they land in the trench or just near the trench?
Well, they were supposed to land in the trench, but you weren't that certainty. You just and the chap. I've seen them fired. The NCO there, and the rifle. Stick the grenade in and fire it. Well, over it'll go. I don't know how they calculated. If it went in the trench every time, of course, I think they were fairly lucky because theirs didn't come into the trench every time. But they were two nasty things. But the nastiest thing of Givenchy and that area was underground mining. That is to say, now we have what they call anti-personnel mines. We had them in the Second War, you stick them in. What I'm talking about, we would actually dig tunnels underground, get under his trench, that had to be calculated, place a mine, and blow up the trench. In that way you could probably blow up 30, 40, 50 men. And apart from doing that to certain... Well, they would be the same. And of course, the REs, they did the mining, but the actual, all this earth had to be carried out. We had a little rhyme. God made bees, the bees made honey. REs do, Yorks do the work and the REs get the money. Because we did the actual hard work and getting digging and carting the stuff out, but the REs supervised and laid the mine. You see, that's that little doggerel. That's what we invented. And as you mine, you probably hear Jerry mining. you can hear the tapping, you see. You can't tunnel without making a noise underground, especially if there's somebody else. And the idea would be trying to blow his mine in, get under him and blow his shaft in. If he didn't, well, he'd continue. Whilst you heard him tapping, you know, you're all right. The mine wasn't laid. But once the tapping ceased, because we'd got sent down chaps to listen, once it ceased, you know, the mine was laid. And you could expect to go and be blown up any time, night or day, the time he chose. Perhaps the time for an attack, which was often the case, or for a raid. And then when a mine went up, there's a question of occupying it, the ridge, that is. The troops would rush out to occupy the ridge as a commanding position. And that was the nasty part of that area.
Did you have
the constant mine?
Did you have to go underground? Because I'm thinking as a stretcher bearer, would you be excused that sort of work?
In the tunnel, there'd be no casualties, unless, of course, they happened to bump into the Jerrys, then there would be. But so I never went into a mine shaft.
You didn't actually go visit?
No.
Were any mines exploded on either side while you were actually there?
No, there wasn't. Not whilst we were actually there. And we were in the area of one called the Red Dragon. That was where, I think, an old company of the Welsh regiment had been blown up. That was why it was called the Red Dragon, or of that brigade, the Welsh Brigade. And again, this is hearsay, that the yarn was that a Jerry had given himself up and warned our fellows that there's a mine going to go up. And the HQ apparently thought this was a trick, that Jerry was going to attack. Gets us out of the front line track. I'm speaking of what happened before we took over, this Red Dragon. So instead of withdrawing the troops from that area, they put two companies in and the mine went up. That's what we heard. But nevertheless, it's a very callous thing to say that when we knew there was a mine under us, we'd be relieved at not going up. We sort of inwardly, I won't say it was outwardly spoken, but inwardly hoped that the damn thing would go up whilst we were out, and didn't matter. I mean, it was every man for himself. It had to go up, and we hoped it'd go up when somebody else was in. The relieving troops, in other words. And that is just a callous thought. Obviously, you prefer the other fellows to get it than you.
How long?
Because soldiers can be, you do get hardened, and they can be very nasty. I've heard nasty talk.
In what way?
I've heard men boast of atrocities. And I won't name them.
What sort of things would people admit to?
Oh, I wouldn't like it, to be on record. I wouldn't like it. I'll tell you after, but I wouldn't like it to be on record. As I say, I only heard this fellow, he might have been boasting.
It was a minority occurrence, meeting this sort of thing.
I've forgotten whether it was when I was in the thing, when I was going on leave. I know I was going back in a railway carriage, and the chap up, and we were all soldiers there, and they were talking and boasting, you know, what they'd done and all that, and this fellow and boasted and this. I don't know whether it was when I was wounded or when I was going on leave. You know, I went on leave in the December previous. I've forgotten on which date. I think it was when I was wounded, this fellow was boasting. And I'd heard of other things, because that area, La Bassée, was the mining area of France, you know. There's lots of mines there. And I'd heard of people being, soldiers being thrown down the mine, down the mine shaft. That's only yarns. Wouldn't say it happened. But one hears things like that. Atrocities. We rightly accuse the Germans of atrocities in both wars. But when you read the papers today of the crimes, you can't say that an Englishman wouldn't commit the same atrocities. It's the terrible crimes that's happening now, where people, old people are stabbed and girls are stabbed and things like that. So you can't say that. And anyhow, you've seen the football, the crowds in the football, right? The fanatics. And so we're not a special race. We're human, same as the Jerrys. And what they've done, we can do, as our past history proves. Our past history is very much the same as all European history.
Would you say this sort of thing was common, though, or that it was...
Oh, no, not common.
You said in late September you went back to the Somme.
Ah.
How had things changed when you got back to the Somme?
Well, they seem to have advanced kind of fairly bit. We, from our point of view, it seemed as though they had advanced, but perhaps obviously they hadn't broken through, but they'd advanced. And we were out on bivouacking out, and alongside us was the Liverpool Pals. And there again I heard of a horrible accident. This is only a hearsay, whether it actually happened or not, but the day it happened we heard of this, because the whole area was strewn with battle debris, guns and the dead had been collected, but nevertheless there was grenades and all kinds of things lying around, and apparently the NCOs were having a little talk, being briefed or something, and an NCO approaching picked up a grenade. There was a rifle, a Jerry Spud masher, hadn't gone off, and jokingly said, "Share that among." That's where we used to, that was a popular saying sometimes used when throwing a bomb down the dugout, for instance. How many of down there, if a jury often you wouldn't find a jury could speak English, six, right, share that amongst you, throw a grenade, you see. Well, this chap picked up the bomb, laughingly said, show that again. He didn't, because there's a string which you should pull. He didn't pull it, but it must have knocked out, and it went off and wounded quite a lot of the NCOs. That was the hearsay. But those are the kind of accidents that can happen. Those are kind of accidents.
Was that sort of horseplay, I mean, a terrible result, but was that sort of joking common?
No. Especially. I've seen it happen once before, at very close quarters, at Givenchy, before we left. We were in the front line, and the front line trench is like what do you call it, crenelé. In French, I've forgotten things.
Crenelated, in trenches, yeah.
Yes. And I was in a bay, you know, call them bays, with a couple of chaps, and blow me, an RE came along the trench, and he got one of these, what we call spudmasher bombs, in his hand, and he was playing with it, but he was drunk. And I remember vaguely shouting to him, "Hey, be careful, chum." And he went round the next traverse, and bang, he went off. Went round, and it stunk of rum, but he was dead and blown, absolutely in pieces.